The Crusaders can only pay about 60%. There's at least 35,000, 34,000 marks, I think, short. And at this point, the Venetians are really put in a difficult position. And it's often argued that the Venetians had somehow weaseled their way into getting this contract and then deliberately redirected the crusade for Venetian interests. And far from it. The arrangement that was finally worked out was that Venice agreed to go on crusade. The Venetians, well, what else can we do? They take the pledge in San Marco. They agree to go on crusade in November of 1202. And they also agree, and this is part of the original treaty, that the Crusaders and Venetians, who are now both in effect Crusaders, are going to operate together, and that the first objective is going to be the city of Zara, which is today on the Dalmatian coast, former Yugoslavia, a Latin-speaking city that had been a possession of Venice, but had recently been occupied by forces loyal to the King of Hungary. And the Venetians agree, look, we need a port to winter in, Zara's on the way, it's an important base for naval stores, and you can work out part of the debt. The Crusaders very reluctantly agree to this. There is an urgency in the nobility of the Fourth Crusade to keep the Crusade together because it's ready to break apart. And so in the fall of 1202, the Fourth Crusade attacks a Christian city, a Latin Christian city. It is embarrassing. The defenders actually suspend crosses from the walls. Many of the Crusaders have qualms about it. The city is taken. It's sacked. The Venetians and Crusaders settle into a winter there. The next objective is apparently to sail to Egypt. Innocent III is furious. This is not a pose. His correspondence shows quite clearly that Innocent was against this altogether. He excommunicates the whole lot. He relents on the Crusaders, but the Venetians remain under excommunication. This is not what's intended. That crusade is to get to Egypt immediately. But as the spring of 1203 arrives, the crusade is still in financial difficulty. Parts of the crusade are defecting. They're sailing to Palestine on their own. The Venetians are still owed an enormous amount of money. There's a great debt. There's a problem of getting provisions. And it's at this point another opportunity emerges. An exiled prince from Constantinople, Alexis Angelus, the son of the weak-willed Isaac II, the foolish emperor who had made the treaty with Saladin and annoyed Frederick Barbarossa. His father had been deposed by his uncle, also named Alexis, the Emperor Alexis III. And this prince, who was a brother-in-law to the then king of Germany, Philip of Swabia, shows up at the Crusaders' residence pleading for assistance to put him on the throne. He, like all exiles, exaggerates his influence in Constantinople. The evil uncle is hated. He also agrees to remarkable terms. He will pay the Crusader debt. He offers 200,000 marks of cologne in money. He will lead an army of 10,000 to Jerusalem. He will maintain 500 knights in Jerusalem ever after. Henry II did 200. He's going to up. Everything is promised. And the irony is, here is a Byzantine exiled prince, the future Alexis IV, swearing oaths on the bones of saints to Crusaders, agreeing to all these terms if the Crusaders will put him on the throne. That is a very far way that the empire has come from back in 1097 when the Emperor Alexis I was taking oaths from the Crusaders to obey him. It is a remarkable role reversal here. And the Crusader leadership agrees to this. How seriously they understood what these oaths meant or whether the kid could deliver on the terms, we don't know. And we'll deal with that in the second lecture, the next lecture coming up. But the oaths are agreed to, the Crusade set sail, and in June of 1203, the Crusader fleet comes into the Bosporus and proclaims to the population in Constantinople, "We have your emperor." And they are received by a bombardment of artillery and jeers from the Varangian Guard. And all of a sudden, the Fourth Crusade finds itself in a real danger.